Welcome to the CJB Sports Show podcast. On this episode, it's going to the Johns. John Hodge of Three Down Nation joins us to look back at the CFL Combine in Winnipeg. And John Collin, curling commentator, on Rachel Homan's incredible win at the World Women's Curling Championship and her amazing season. That's one of the best seasons we've ever seen in curling. The Johns are next on the podcast. The CFL Combine has come and gone with dozens of potential future CFL players making their way through Winnipeg. The interviews and the testing and the practices, and a man who took it all in is our friend John Hodge from Three Down Nation. John, how much time did you spend at the Fort Garry and the Winnipeg Soccer Federation building on Leela this past week?
Oh, geez. More hours than I did sleeping. I'll put it that way, Christian. It's always a lot of fun covering the CFL events. Always nice, however, when they are done, and you could get so much needed rest. So I'm delighted that the combine happened, but also pleased that it's over and I get a bit of a chance to rest up.
An overview first. How do you think it went in Winnipeg?
I thought it was great. Yeah, I've been at the last six CFL combines. There are a couple that didn't happen, of course, due to the pandemic, but I've been at them all since 2017, including the one that was in Winnipeg in 2018, and I thought this was arguably the best one. I mean, the players performed really well. That's part of it. There were some injuries and some illnesses that kept players out the last 2 days of practice, but we still got a chance to see most of these guys test. And I thought the Fort Garry, I mean, obviously the Fort Garry is beautiful, and the Winnipeg Federation Center in North Winnipeg for the soccer complex there, I thought was outstanding. I'd never been inside that building, and the players were raving about the surface, and the coaches were very pleased with, you know, the sight lines. I was there obviously as a member of the media, and the 360 kind of upper level that they have there, I thought was sensational for viewing. I got really, really good angles of all the players, and it's frustrating sometimes in combines in the past when you're at grass level and you're having to look through 3, 4, 5, 6 rows of people to see what the heck is going on. And not only did they have great sight lines at the combine, but the live stream that happened, especially that third day of practice yesterday, I thought looked really sharp. So to me, I thought the event felt like a very strong success.
And how far has it come along since the first one you went to 7 or 8 years ago?
Well, I mean, I think the talent level has gotten better. The biggest change would have happened last year when instead of having kind of a three-day event where you have kind of measuring and interviews one day, testing the next, and then some drills on the third, they've essentially taken that third day and turned it into three different days where guys get more of an opportunity to get coaching, more of an opportunity to go through drills. And the idea was essentially to say, hey, look, you know, especially at the youth sports level, the budgets are limited, right? These players don't get as much coaching as a lot of players do in the NCAA. So what if instead of just having one day as kind of a one-off, we would give coaches a chance to actually work with these guys a bit, and we could see which players, you know, not only look good on day one, but maybe which guys maybe don't look great on day one, but by day three are already showing signs of improvement or showing the ability to kind of take what they've learned in those coaching sessions and apply it quickly in a potentially in a way, of course, to raise their draft stock. So that'd be the biggest change. And personally, I like it. And I like getting more of an opportunity to watch these players compete.
From a fan perspective, how inclusive is the experience for people that come out and now the live stream as well for fans that want to embrace the combine?
Yeah, I mean, the center up north in the soccer complex was open to the public. I believe you had to register for tickets to come, but it was free. And yeah, I mean, there was lots of Bomber fans out. I saw a lot of people wearing Bomber gear in and around kind of the viewing area. I had a couple people come up to me who read my stuff on Three Down or who listen to our podcast every week, and that was great, getting the chance to kind of interact with those folks. And I mean, it's, you know, it's late March, right, Christian? Like, people are kind of starved for football, and especially CFL football. So I think giving fans the opportunity to come and celebrate that and hang out and maybe see, you know, fellow fans they haven't seen since the end of last season is pretty cool. I did tell a number of CFL staffers, you know, this soccer complex is so good for this. You guys should have it every year. And they all said the same thing, which was, you sound like Wade Miller, because I guess the president and CEO of the Bombers has been, you know, courting the league, I guess. The next year's combine is already set for Regina. We'll be in Regina in 2025, but who knows? Maybe we'll be back in Winnipeg come 2026.
So who, if I could ask, of all the people that were there, who jumped out at you the most watching them compete in the combine?
The first person I'd have to say is Joel DeBlanco. Joel DeBlanco in 2022 went undrafted in the 2022 NFL draft and had a couple cups of coffee with the New Orleans Saints, with the Seattle Seahawks, and has since played in the USFL. Now, he just qualified for Canadian citizenship through his father, who was born in Canada. And the reason he jumped out at me, I mean, it might be a bit of a strange pick, because he's somebody who is already expected to be taken very high in this year's draft. He's kind of drawn comparisons to Alex Singleton, who is another guy who, you know, kind of a big-bodied linebacker who in 2016 qualified for Canadian citizenship after already playing a year of pro. And, of course, a lot of CFL fans will remember how good Alex Singleton was. He, of course, got the opportunity to go back to the NFL and is now making millions and millions of dollars with the Denver Broncos. But the reason DeBlanco stood out is because at his pro day in 2022 at the University of Cincinnati, he weighed in at 240 pounds and he ran a 4.76 40-yard dash, which is fine at the linebacker position by NFL standards. It's not bad by CFL standards. But a lot of players, after they're pro for a year or two, you know, the training that they've done specifically for the 40-yard dash might have worn off a bit. I'm not saying they're slower, but they might not be necessarily as polished in that drill. Well, that was not the case for Joel DeBlanco. He ran a 4.59 40-yard dash at 231 pounds, which is sensational. And I interviewed him. I sat down with him for 30 minutes the day before testing, and he was very optimistic that he was going to improve on a lot of his pro day numbers from 2022. Admittedly, I was skeptical. And he proved, you know, that he was 100% telling the truth. He improved in almost every test. And he went from being a guy where I think teams were going, wow, this guy could be special, to going, holy smokes, this guy is extremely special. And for that reason, I believe he will be the first player off the board come Tuesday, April 30th, when the CFL draft takes place, to the Edmonton Elks.
Does that mean he's going to spend his whole time here, or is the NFL still a priority? Because if you look back at a number of first round picks over the years, it's not a great list of success stories in the CFL, is it?
You're not wrong about that. There have been some first overall busts, that's for sure, in the last few years. And I did talk to some CFL people who were speculating that maybe after running a 4.59, and by the way, at combines, they use a laser system to time these 40-yard dashes literally to the hundredth or even thousandth of a second. And that's not the case at pro days. Pro days are hand timed. Generally, hand times are a little bit better than combine time. So I think a lot of people looked at his pro day from 2 years ago at 4.76 and said, okay, that's probably like a 4.8 laser, maybe 4.85. You know, that's kind of right on the cusp for a CFL middle linebacker. All of a sudden, running 4.59 laser, that could potentially be a tool that he uses to get another NFL look, though he has been out of the league for a full year now. So I think it's possible that he gets an NFL look down the line, but he is already 26, which is something that might work to his disadvantage. He was at Cincinnati for six seasons in college, of course, including 2020, which was the COVID year during which all prospects got the extra year of eligibility in the NCAA. So I think his age works against him a little bit, but strangely, in the way it works in the CFL, is the lower your NFL draft stock is, the higher your CFL draft stock is, because teams know you'll sign right away. So as long as he's not getting that surprise NFL offer over the next few weeks, I think he'll be the first overall pick. And I think he's going to be someone that 5-10 years from now, we talk about as being a very good first overall pick.
Overall, how much do you read into combine results when it comes to projecting who's going to be good in the CFL?
Well, I don't see the combine as something that can completely change somebody's stock. There are stories of players coming to the combine, having disappointing performances, and then having great careers. There's also players who, you know, come to the combine, absolutely blow it up and perform really well, and then don't have very successful careers. So that correlation is not super strong. But what I will say is the combine is a good opportunity to kind of count guys out. Like there are, you know, U Sports players with very good film, and maybe they come to the combine and, you know, as a 180-pound receiver, they run a 4.75. And you kind of go, okay, this guy is, you know, at that weight, you know, he's just not fast enough to play at the pro level. Does that mean he's not a great player? No, he's a great U Sports player. He's a great college player. It just might not translate. That happens. Going the other way is a little bit tougher because if a guy, you know, has no production and the film's not good, and then he shows up and his testing is crazy, then coaches are going, wait, hold on. If this guy has all of this athleticism and all these tools and all this speed and strength, why is the film bad, right? And why was he not more productive? So I think the combine serves, at least on the field and in the testing, as a chance to kind of confirm what teams have seen on tape, maybe see what guys are overachieving their athleticism a little bit, maybe see which guys have a little bit of untapped potential with that athleticism. And then the other thing that is arguably the most important is the interview process. Teams get the opportunity to interview virtually all the players in attendance in 12 and 15 minute segments. And those are great opportunities for teams to say, hey, we've watched this guy on film for the past 3-4 years. We've watched, you know, his highlights. We've watched his lowlights. We know his positive tendencies. We know his negative tendencies. We know how fast he can run, all that stuff. But now we need to just talk to the person, because especially when you get to the mid late rounds of the draft, you often have, you know, if you need a linebacker, there'll be three linebackers there and they all have the same grade and they all have more or less the same athleticism. Well, which one are you picking? Well, you're going to pick the guy who's going to make your locker room better. You're going to pick the guy who shows up on time. You're going to pick the guy who's not going to miss the assignment. You're going to pick the guy with the higher football IQ, right? So that interview process, I think, is the most important thing. Can it hurt a prospect? Yes, because if a prospect, again, doesn't answer for maybe some of the questions they had in college, you know, maybe they can't answer questions positively about, you know, their choice to transfer schools, their choice to quit on a school, an injury they sustain, whatever. But there's also the chance for guys to raise their stock in that interview process by positively answering questions, again, be it about themselves and their personal life or be it about their collegiate football career.
So we're a month away from the draft, just about. At this moment, and I'm sure I'll have you on before the draft, but at this moment, with the Bombers picking 8th overall, what do you see as their highest priority, and is there a guy you see that fits that?
Yes, I think their highest priority has to be along the offensive line. This team is obviously not looking for a starter, right? Yes, Jeff Gray was not retained in free agency, but Liam Dobson, Tui Elie, I think are both going to be candidates to step into that starting role at left guard. But when you look at, you know, Patrick Neufeld getting up there in age, when you look at Chris Kolonkowski getting a big raise, when you look at Liam Dobson going into a contract year, I think the Bombers need to go into the hopper and grab one of these offensive linemen. Now, the good news is there's a lot of good offensive linemen in this draft, and the Bombers are going to get a good one at 8, almost regardless of what the teams ahead of them do. The player who I think would be fantastic for them is the same guy who I mocked to them in my first mock draft, and that's George Una, offensive lineman out of the University of Windsor. Coincidentally, the same school attended by Drew Desjarlais, who worked out really well for this team in the draft in 2019. He tested really well, one of the top testers along the offensive line. I actually thought he was the best offensive lineman in the one-on-ones. The only guy who I think gave him a run for his money out of the University of Laval was Nathaniel Demelin-Duguay, who tested a little better, but isn't quite as big, or at least isn't quite as heavy as George Una. The Lancers in Windsor have a very run-heavy offensive attack, not dissimilar to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. But when I sat down and talked to Una for about 20 minutes the day before testing, he said he actually really loves pass protection. That's the side of his game that he really loves and wants to continue to improve at. So to me, he would be a pretty seamless fit along that offensive line. The only challenge is, you know, if you talked to me a few weeks ago, I would have said, yeah, I think Uno will be there for the Bombers at 8. The only issue is, did he have a good enough of a combine that a team could say, hey, you know what? We don't want to let this guy to fall to 8. We're gonna take him in the first round and beat Winnipeg to the punch. So that's who I would highlight as a potential first round pick for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers.
John, appreciate the insight as always. Thanks for this. Have a great night, and I'm sure we'll have you on right around draft time.
Thanks, Christian. Anytime.
John Hodge, 3 Down Nation. That's where you can find his work on the combine and all kinds of CFL stories.
Well, John, as someone who has been part of curling for, well, first of all, just for my perspective, how long have you been a part of curling? When did curling enter your life?
I started playing, I tried it for the first time when I was 11, and then I started playing organized curling when I was 12, and then, pretty much played competitively from age, I guess, 14 or 15 up until I was 35.
Okay, so a long time then. You've been a part of curling for a long time.
A long time, yes.
Have you seen a curler go on a run like Rachel Homan has the last 5 months?
It is, it's pretty remarkable, Christian. It was, I was talking about this a little bit on Twitter yesterday with some people going back and forth. And really, you know, the sort of gold standard tour season is Mike McEwen in 2014-15. They played 12 events. They made the finals in 11. They won 8. Two of them were slams. One of them was the Canada Cup. They led the money list by $75,000. And that was sort of the gold standard tour season. The problem for Mike was that he didn't make it out of Manitoba. He lost the Manitoba final that year, and there were no wild cards at the Brier at that time. So, you know, when you think of, and their winning percentage that season was 86. So you think of that as being like the gold standard, right? And then you take Rachel Homan's season, winning percentage of almost 92% on the season. They've won 7 events. They have more Bonspiel wins than they have total losses. And then you include an undefeated Scotties and a 1-loss world championship on top of that. I think it's almost impossible to argue that we're not watching the best season ever. I mean, recency bias is always a hell of a drug, but it certainly seems like this is it. And especially if they go on and, you know, finish the year with a win at the Players, I think there's just no doubt.
It's tough sometimes to compare across eras because of how curling has changed so much over the years with the men's team. You know, the Brier, for most of its existence, the defending champion didn't get an automatic berth back the next year. The women's game didn't have Northern Ontario for a very long time, and the Grand Slam of curling has been a more recent addition. Plus now, as you mentioned, wild card teams, the biggest field we've ever had in the national championship. But still, you play the games that are in front of you regardless of where they are, and the win percentage speaks for itself, and the quality of opposition as well. The world championship in 2024 is really hard compared to maybe 30 years ago. I feel there's so many more teams that the depth is really fantastic. A team like, you know, Anna Hasselberg, who has won the Olympics, started 0-3 because it's such a hard field. How much does that in your eyes, boost Homan's resume and what she's been able to do, specifically looking at this Worlds that she won yesterday?
Yeah, no question. You know, I think it's funny because people do say that about the wild card. Oh, well, you know, she got a free berth to the Scotties. Well, yes, that's true on one hand. But on the other hand, that also means that all of the top teams are in the Scotties now, right? When you have the wild card spots, it makes the Scotties field harder, not easier. Maybe you could say, oh, well, she got in for free. But, you know, no disrespect, Danielle Inglis, great curler, great team. Carly Howard, Chelsea Brandwood, you know, those Haley Armstrong in Ontario, they're all good teams. Was Homan going to lose the Ontario Provincials this year? Not a chance. So, you know, yeah, I think you could make the case the Scotties field is harder, and then absolutely the World's field is harder. And I mean, you said 30 years ago, you know, I can think back to even 2010, the 2010 Olympics. The women's side, maybe not so much, but the men's side, you know, there were absolutely free bingo spaces on that card. France was in the 2010 Olympics. You know, we haven't really heard from them since then. You had China, who never really made a ton of noise on the men's stage. You had like a 23-year-old Nicolas Hedin. You had an aging Swiss team. Like the Olympics, even 14 years ago, were not as competitive as they are now. So, I mean, that makes it almost easier to compare, because you're not even, it's not even really a comparison. I mean, you know, the, it used to be, you take for granted, you win the Brier, you win the Scotties, you're either going to win the Worlds or you're going to be very competitive, and you're going to have 3 to 5 free wins at the Worlds. Those don't exist anymore, you know, and even for Rachel, like look at, you know, her game against Turkeya was maybe her hardest game of the week. And you'd probably look before the week and go, oh, you know, you got Turkeya, you got Estonia, maybe those are free bingo spaces, but you know, Turkeya played unbelievable against them and almost beat them. So yeah, it's absolutely as hard now to win any event as it's ever been, in my opinion.
So let's look at where, how we got to this point over the weekend. Let's start with the Korea semifinal win, where it was a total dogfight. They had to, there were no steals on the board. They had to earn every point. And I mean, it came down to a 10th end that I was wondering if this event was played somewhere else without the fan support, would Canada have won that game?
Yeah, it's funny when you look at their record this year. So weirdly enough, Rachel has lost 6 games, but it's only to 3 teams, and she's lost 4 times to Yunji Gim. So she's lost 4 times this season to Gim, once to Carrie Anderson, and once to Stefania Constantini, and she's undefeated against everybody else. So, and then, of course, they lost to Korea. That was their only loss of the Worlds on that final day of the round robin. So, yeah, I mean, the home crowd in Sydney, there's no question, played a huge role. You know, do they not win if they're somewhere else? I don't know. That's always hard to quantify, but certainly it was a matter of just waiting for Gim to blink, and they were not blinking until later in that game. And yeah, maybe you could make the case that the crowd kind of weighed on them and the pressure eventually caught up to them. But yeah, they've been a thorn in the side of Homan all season long. And I'm sure Rachel Homan thought, great, of all the teams we could play in the semifinal, it's going to be Yunji Gim. But yeah, it was certainly, they had to scrap for it. They were very patient, and ultimately they finally got a couple misses out of Gim, and Rachel was right there to capitalize, as she has been for so much of this season.
A 9-7 win, with Homan getting 3 in the 10th to seal the win there. And then we get the gold medal showdown that everybody wanted. I think most of us expected. You've got the hottest team in curling in Team Homan, putting together one of the best seasons ever, against the 4-time reigning defending champion out of Switzerland, who had won 42 games in a row until Homan beat them in the round robin at this event. And it's force, deuce, force, deuce. And now they're down 4-2 after 4. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, this isn't looking great. And then out of nowhere, they score a deuce in 5. And the game totally changed.
Yeah, it was one of those, as a fan and someone who's, you know, been around the game for a long time, you watched the start of that game and it felt like Tirinzoni was doing to Homan what Homan has been doing to teams all year. Homan wasn't even really playing that badly. And when I say Homan, I mean the team, you know, but it was just one of those, they would just miss, you know, it was like they wouldn't quite get a hit and roll, or they'd over roll a little bit, or they would come a hair deep on a draw. And it was just like every single time they were doing that, Tirinzoni and specifically Alina Petz, who I believe was curling 100% through the first 6 ends, were just capitalizing on every single mistake. And you just sat there and you thought, oh my God, you know, Homan is just not quite as sharp as they should be, and Switzerland is as good as we'd expect from a 4-time defending champion. And then, yeah, you're right. That 2-5 wasn't necessarily like an amazing 2, but they got that tie going into the 5th end break. And then, yeah, it just totally changed in the second half. Homan was a completely different team, and you have to give it up for them. You know, in a lot of those games, you see when one team comes out, we just saw it in the Brier final, right? McEwen came out a little flat. Brad Guju jumped out to a 5-1 lead. Mike McEwen got, you know, he got himself back into the mix, but eventually Brad Gugiu ended up winning. And I think, you know, that's kind of what I thought would happen. But Team Holman, like for Tirinzoni, but Team Holman was able to turn it around. And yeah, their second half of the game was impeccable. And Rachel herself, I mean, you know, what more can you say? Just made some absolutely unbelievable shots at the right times, and they were full value for the win in the end.
So yeah, they turned the game around. Blanks in 6 and 7. They forced Switzerland in 8. And you know, Switzerland's not too upset with that. If they can force in 9, they've got the hammer coming home and they're tied. But Holman makes a nice double. Pets can't make a triple. And it didn't seem like Switzerland really noticed the potential of the split. And I noticed it right away watching it. I thought, oh, they could split that, but I didn't think they'd actually do it. It just kind of crossed my mind. It's like, yeah, that would be cool if they could do that, but they'll probably just draw for 2. And then they started talking about it, and Holman's just making everything. So the anticipation of that coming down, the crowd rising, you could sense it in the voices of Holman and Tracy Fleury in the house. They knew it was close, and they knew if they could make this shot, they might win the world championship. And the place goes nuts. She makes it for 3. And they win it on that one because the 10th falls apart for Switzerland pretty fast. I mean, that's a legendary shot for Rachel Holman, is it not?
No question. You know, I said it on Twitter. You know, that's a shot we're going to be seeing in highlight packages for years. It's not just the shot. You know, I think people see that rock close to the rings and they think, okay, well, that's an easily splittable rock. Well, for Rachel to make it, they had to outcount the 2 Swiss stones in the back 12. And the only way to do that was crossing the face. When you're crossing the face of the stone on a split, that automatically makes it harder. And then the fact that you had to roll both of the stones into the full 12, the degree of difficulty was so high. And I think, too, the risk, you know, often when skips go to play a split, the thought is, well, you know, we play this cautiously. So if we get the line wrong, we'll still get 2, right? We'll still end up hitting the nose of it and we'll bump it in, or we'll miss the split stone completely, but it'll stop in time. With that split, Rachel had to throw enough weight that if she doesn't make contact with that stone or she just edges off of it, her shooter's going through the house and they only get 1. And so I think, you know, when you add all of those factors together, absolutely incredible shot, as you alluded to, team shot. You know, Tracy called the line perfectly, and you know, even had to fight off Rachel on the sweep call as well. It was an unbelievable shot, and as I say, it's one that we'll be seeing for years to come for sure.
So I think one of the reasons why Canada decided to just give automatic berths into the national championships now, like Rachel Holman and Jennifer Jones got this past year, is to better prepare us to compete on the world stage, because we have not been winning Olympic medals very much since 2014. We have not been winning world championships all that often. So I think it's a 1-year sample size, but so far so good for this new strategy from Curling Canada.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the three wild cards have been going since COVID. This is the first year that they, you know, sort of pre-qualified the wild cards, where they pre-qualified 2, and then next year they're going to pre-qualify all 3. I think there's no question about it. I think, you know, we're at the point now where, yes, it's nice to say we want the Brier and Scotties to have all the provincial representation, and I think that is important and it is tradition. But on some level, we got to win as well, you know? And so I think what they've found right now is a happy medium. You're still getting the provincial representation. You're getting most of the best teams in the country into the national championships. And I think when people complain about the wild cards, you know, what they're sort of not realizing here is like the alternative to wild cards is that the team gets picked. Like that is the potential road we're heading down. You know, we just hired Dave Murdoch to be the head of high performance for Curling Canada. Guess what he did in Scotland? He streamlined the model. They fund 1 team in Scotland. And when they fund them, it's like, you know, at the expense of the other teams. They're sometimes pulling team members from this team and that team. The USA has also done that for a while. So it's like, you know, if you don't like wild cards, you have to think about, you know, what the other options would be. And nobody wants the team to be selected, I don't think. So I think, yeah, they found a really good balance of keeping the Brier and Scotties competitive, getting all the best teams in there while still holding on to what makes our national championships great.
All right, I'll get you out of here on a men's question because the men's world championship is next on the Rota, and Brad Guju going back again, insane that he just couldn't ever win the big one, and now 6 times in 8 years he's won the Brier. It's what a run he's been on.
Crazy.
It's hard to wrap your mind around sometimes, and with mostly the same team, right? EJ is in, Brett Gallant is out, but Walker's been there the whole time. Nichols was there in 06 when they won Olympic gold. What does it look like for their chances going into this field for the Worlds this year?
Yeah, I was talking about this earlier today as well, because it's a really fascinating World Championships this year on the men's side. You have, you know, sort of all of your established players are going into the men's Worlds badly. You know, it's been a bad season for a lot of the perennial contenders on the men's side. You have Brad Guju going in. Yes, he looked great at the Brier. This is his worst tour season in probably the last 7 or 8 years. He fell from number one in the world to number seven, I believe. I think he went up since the Brier, but going into the Brier, he was number seven. You have Nicholas Adin, who's had an on-again, off-again season. He's coming off of surgery again this season. They haven't looked amazing. Bruce Mowat, it's been all peaks and valleys for them this year. They didn't even make the final of the Scottish Nationals. That was Ross White against James Craik. Bruce Mowat came third. Scotland decided to send them to Worlds anyway. So your sort of old guard of teams that we're used to seeing be competitive are all kind of coming in off of not great seasons. John Schuster, you could also put in there for the USA, has not had a good season. Then you have the world number one, Joel Retournaz, who has yet to prove himself at a world championship, obviously has won a couple slams, is world number one, but we haven't seen him really put it together at a Worlds. We've got Yannick Schwaller, who has experience on his team. Benoit Schwarz is an Olympic bronze medalist. He's the fourth rock thrower for that team. But again, Benoit's never, made a ton of noise in the world stage. Yannick, this is a new team. This is only their second year together. So I'm really fascinated. You know, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. Normally going into a Worlds, it is really just about who the best teams are. Often the best teams are going to show themselves over the course of the week. This has a bit of a throwback feel where I think it's almost whoever gets hot at the Worlds is going to win it. I think any of those kind of top six teams that I mentioned, it would not be crazy to see them win. And when we're talking about Canada, I think it's the same for Brad Guju. I think I would not be surprised to see him win gold. I would also not be surprised to see him barely squeak into the playoffs and come fifth or sixth. So it's going to be a really fascinating one to watch. I'm super excited for it.
And that starts Saturday in Switzerland. John, appreciate your insight on this. As always, great conversation. We'll have you on again soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Christian. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for listening to the CJOB Sports Show podcast. If you like what you heard, guess what? You can hear more every weeknight on CJOB from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Thanks again for tuning in. Subscribe if you'd like. We're available on iTunes and other places, I'd imagine. So farewell until we meet again. And thanks for all the fish. So sad that it should come to this. We try to warn you all, but it didn't.